Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.
Well, they say records are there to be broken, and sadly, that is exactly what happened at Old Trafford this weekend. Not since May 1991 had Manchester United been defeated by Crystal Palace in league competition. That amounted to 22 league meetings and 20 in the Premier League. The best record from one team over another team in the history of the Premier League, no less. However, yesterday that record came to a shuddering halt as the Eagles rocked the Red Devils with a 2-1 victory at Old Trafford. And Patrick Van Aanholt became the first man to score an injury time winner at Old Trafford in the Premier League. Goals from Jordan Ayew, just his second since joining Crystal Palace at the start of last season. And Patrick Van Aanholt, shortly after United had restored parity through Daniel James, meant Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's side had evened things up nicely in their opening three games. One win, one draw, one defeat. As always, I'm joined by Mark Flanagan, LSR Northwest correspondent. Mark, how are you doing?
Hi there.
Are you well? Are you good? Are you feeling positive after yesterday? It was a good performance, but obviously not the best result.
I'm just hoping Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is going to sign Ben Stokes to play up front when the next transfer window. I think that's looking a decent bet, and they're probably their best hope for a prolific goal scorer at the moment.
Well, indeed, all the talk has been about Ben Stokes today. We do have to mention, in fact, of course, England won that third Ashes test against Australia and that fourth test at Old Trafford, of course. Nice and topical for this particular show. If they win that, it's 1-1 at the moment. Could they go 2-1 up in the Ashes against all odds? A fantastic performance today, wasn't it?
Yeah, special. I think when they were 17 for 2 or 21 for 2, I can't remember exactly what it was. I think they were 500 to 1 to win the match, which gives you an idea of the just how extraordinary it was, really.
Well, extraordinary indeed. And yesterday was extraordinary. When that goal went in from Daniel James, I have to say, I thought, here we go. This is United of old again. We're going to go and we're going to get a winner in injury time. It turned out to go in the opposite direction. Patrick Van Aanholt, the first person to score an injury time winner at Old Trafford in the Premier League. That is quite a remarkable stat considering the Premier League started in 1992. We're now in 2019. Incredible.
Yeah, kind of sums up so much of what's happened at Manchester United since Ole Gunnar Solskjaer got his contract full time. Just the way that the ball rebounded off De Gea into the net, went through him. You just think 3 years ago, that ball is never going in the net. He's gone off the boil. And United, after the fantastic start with a fantastic result, I think I said on the show actually a couple of weeks ago, it was the least convincing 4-0 win I've ever seen. I think what's happened in the intervening couple of games has kind of put United in their proper place in terms of what happened at Wolves, you know, outplayed in the second half, equaliser. And again, yesterday, I mean, you know, in the two games against Wolves and again against Palace, United had 70% possession, but only 5 shots on goal in 180 minutes of football. And if you're not going to kill teams off, I mean, obviously they missed a penalty and Pogba missed a penalty against Wolves, then, you know, you're laying yourself open for things like that to happen. And they just went for it, tried to, you know, get the second and Palace caught them on the break. And, you know, teams like Man City and Liverpool open up 3-4 goal gaps regularly. United really have struggled. It's been a real theme of the last sort of 2 years that they've struggled to kill off teams and, you know, winning a lot of games by the odd goal. It's not good. I think, you know, the situation with the penalty taker as well, which, you know, I know we were going to go on to discuss, kind of highlights an issue that I'm increasingly thinking Solskjaer's got a big problem in that dressing room. The fact that he's got two penalty takers is something I've never heard of. I've never heard of it before. I think the only reason you do that is you don't want to upset even the players, so you can compromise it, actually.
Oh, I think we've lost Mark Flanagan there. He was, of course, alluding to the fact that United now seem to have two penalty takers in the ranks. Marcus Rashford and, of course, Paul Pogba. And there is a fear with this that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has come out and said, listen, I've got two penalty takers. It depends on who's confident at the time as to who is going to be that penalty taker. Mark, I think you're back with us.
Yes, I am indeed, yeah. Can you hear me okay?
I can, yeah. I just want to... So this whole penalty debate, we're going to go straight onto it because you've mentioned it there. And the fact that, for me, when I listened to what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer said, and I allude to Unai Emery with this, because Unai Emery has made a point of not appointing a captain yet at Arsenal. And it generally is going to be Granit Xhaka, but he's come out and said, you know, I haven't got a first team captain yet that is going to be that number one captain. Of course, players from last season, Petr Cech, Aaron Ramsey, they've moved on now, so he can't go to them. Why not just name a captain and not have that as something that can come back to you? In this case, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, by not naming a guaranteed penalty taker, he's building a rod for his own back, because like you said, what that does, it shows a little bit of weakness, and it suggests that you're not turning around to Paul Pogba and saying, look, Marcus Rashford is the penalty taker, end of.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know how much of it, where I was when I broke up, but I was saying that the only reason that you would do that is to not upset them. You're trying to come up with a compromise because you're trying to keep both of them happy. Well, they know in the back of their minds that the fact that he's even having to do that kind of undermines him. It shows a weakness. And at that level, you cannot show any kind of weakness with these sort of, you know, elite athletes. They will seize on any weakness and sort of use it and exploit it in terms of if they think they can argue their case, if they think they can kind of undermine you and test you out and test your strength of character, because they won't be 100% certain about Solskjaer as a Manchester United manager. And I just think a lot of players in the squad will look at that and think, well, that's another test that he's failed in terms of is he the real deal? You know, not parking in Ferguson's parking space. Well, why have you done that? Openly admitting that you've been consulting Ferguson. Have they not learned anything from what happened under Matt Busby, you know, the intervening years after Busby left? All the problems that they had with trying to find a successor to Busby and Busby being in the background.
We've lost Mark Flanagan again. Not quite sure what's going on the line there, but his point about the fact that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer hasn't been able to, I guess, assert his authority at the club so far since taking over. The fact that when he took the job, he seemed slightly starstruck. It all seemed a bit odd about the fact that he did say this was his dream job. And I know that Frank Lampard has said the same thing since he's been in charge of Arsenal. But it just seemed that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, it almost felt like he'd won the lottery when he got that Manchester United job. And the fact that he won't park in Alex Ferguson's parking spot, he's almost just illuminating that spectre of Sir Alex Ferguson that seemed to hang over David Moyes when he was in the job, with Louis van Gaal as well, and Jose Mourinho. I know that Sir Alex Ferguson goes to the games week in, week out, and he's got a special relationship with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, but that is not helping his cause whatsoever in this sense. And for Ole to not designate a guaranteed penalty taker, it's just building a rod for his own back. It's causing an argument that he absolutely doesn't need as Manchester United manager. He's already under an immense amount of pressure. And to not name a penalty taker, a designated penalty taker. And look, if Paul Pogba scores that penalty against Wolves, we're not having this discussion. But with Marcus Rashford, as we know, as has been reported throughout the world, throughout England, everywhere we've seen it, Marcus Rashford scored a penalty on that opening game of the season against Chelsea. All he needed to do was step up against Wolves and take a penalty again. Was it in his mind in this clash against Crystal Palace? We don't know. Mark, I believe you're back on the line.
I am indeed. Sorry about that.
No, not a problem. But basically, I was just talking about the fact that this is an argument and a debate that we don't need to be having. And it frustrates me that we're talking about it on this show. But what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer did by not saying to Marcus Rashford, and listen, we don't know if there was a clear directive from management. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, we're hearing varying reports that on one hand, Ole is torn into them behind closed doors. On the other hand, we're hearing that he said, you know, we've got two penalty takers. That is what it is. I cannot accept that Marcus Rashford didn't want to take that penalty against Wolves. As a striker of Manchester United that needs to aim for 15, 20 plus goals this season, I know Paul Pogba won that penalty, like Marcus Rashford won the penalty against Chelsea, which is why he took it. But Paul Pogba even should surely be looking at Marcus Rashford and going, do you know what? You have it. You're the striker. You've already scored one. You have it.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's got a better record than Pogba. And Pogba's missed quite a few. And the other thing is, you're absolutely right. It's created an issue when I can't think of another occasion where this has been an issue at a football club where there's been this debate about having two penalty takers. It's extraordinary that he didn't foresee that there was a potential problem in that if both players missed or either player missed, it would automatically become an issue. And like you say, it can't possibly have helped the situation. It's got to be in Rashford's mind that he's thinking, as he stood over that ball waiting to take that penalty, thinking, oh, there's going to be extra on this. If I miss this, there's going to be extra on this now. This is already an issue. If I miss this, it becomes an even bigger issue. And those things can make a difference. It just takes them out of their comfort zone. When he's actually taking penalties, and he's taken some great penalties for Manchester United, and I think in England as well, I think at the World Cup, I'm 100% certain, but I'm sure he did. That, you know, it just any kind of little distraction like that can make a huge difference. And, you know, those couple of inches that he struck it further wider than he might have otherwise did, and it hit the post and bounced across the goal. You know, who's to say that wasn't the difference between them scoring and 3 points? And now, all of a sudden, after that, you know, win against Chelsea, 4 points after three games, you're suddenly looking at Southampton away next week and thinking, oh, actually, that's a bit tricky now. Southampton have had a good coming. You know, they've had a good win. You know, they've got a canny manager who knows how to set them up against big teams. They made it really awkward against Liverpool for a long period of that game. You know, that's going to be a really difficult ask. And all of a sudden, you go into, if United don't win that and they go into the international break with 4 or 5 points, that's going to really, really ramp up the pressure on Solskjaer when, you know, with the penalty issue and everything else that's happened, you know, 7 points, it would have been a completely different story. And it just seems a theme at United over the last 2 or 3 years that almost creating problems for themselves when they don't really need to. And you do wonder, you know, long-term Solskjaer. I've never been convinced by him. I think I've said on Love Sport a few times that I just don't think he's got the personality to deal with, you know, a club as the size of Manchester United. It takes a very, very special person to manage Manchester United. And I'm sorry, but he did poorly at Cardiff. And, you know, if you do poorly at that level, how is that make you someone who should be even in contention for a job? They should be looking at looking for the next Alex Ferguson. I know that's easy said than done, but they should be looking for, you know, someone, they should be thinking who's the best manager in the world? That's who, you know, the new Guardiola, the new Klopp. You know, when Alex Ferguson and Matt Busby, their two most successful managers ever, had nothing to do with Manchester United prior to their appointment. This thing of going back to the Fergie way, the Manchester United way, someone with Manchester United in his DNA, why do they need that? Why don't they just get Klopp? Klopp had nothing to do with Liverpool. You know, Mourinho had nothing to do with Chelsea. Wenger had nothing to do with Arsenal. All these guys who've been really successful recently had nothing to do with the clubs where they ended up being successful. Just get the best guy instead of worrying about, you know, the DNA of United. It's a meaningless thing. It's a meaningless statement. And it just also shows up, you know, the hierarchy and the people appointing the managers as well, because, you know, it just shows a lack of football understanding. It's almost pandering to the sort of base instinct of the fans, you know, the comfort blanket of appointing a former player who was a really nice guy, who's a really popular player. But that doesn't improve you on the football pitch. That doesn't improve you as a football club. That doesn't win you cups. And I think, you know, United fans, the United fans who know what they're talking about would have been thinking about that as well. But, you know, the pandering, I think, to, you know, the not for the first time, the sort of the management and the directors are pandering to the sort of the base instinct of the widespread worldwide support. And that is never a recipe for success in football and in so many other businesses as well.
Yeah, it just goes to show how ill-prepared the club seemed to have been after that resignation of Sir Alex Ferguson. And actually, do you know what? If they had a better conversation and he'd said, look, I'll stick around for a couple of more seasons, you probably could have bagged a Pep Guardiola, because Manuel Pellegrini would have left Man City, and by that time, Guardiola would have been tapped up by United. Anyway, more of that on the Manchester United Fan Show on Love Sport.
Love Sport.
This is the Manchester United Fan Show on Love Sport with you through to 10 p.m. this evening. Myself, Matt Beadle, currently joined by LSR Northwest correspondent Mark Flanagan. Now, Mark, in that first segment, you did bring up Mr. David De Gea. This is a man who we believe, despite all the speculation, still has not signed a new contract at Manchester United. It was an error for the second goal on his part. It was a strong shot from Van Aanholt, but that's a shot that David De Gea should be saving. There's been a lot of report. I mean, everybody's called it a howler. Everyone said that he's past his best. Everyone said that his time at Manchester United should perhaps be done. He needs to move on. What do you think on De Gea at the moment as things stand? And do you want him to sign a new contract? Because if he doesn't, where do United go from there on?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. You almost sort of take it back to the point where he nearly left United to go to Real Madrid. Obviously, you know, that was his preferred thing, preferred option. Once Madrid made it clear that Courtois was going to be their selection and was their choice and was a better bet for them sort of long term, it really kind of cut short his options in terms of where he could go. You know, Barcelona was never going to be an option with his, you know, with his Madrid links. You know, PSG is his kind of last remaining sort of big money option. And the fact that he hasn't, you know, signed an incredibly lucrative contract because he's haggling over this idea that he wants to be, you know, on a par with the highest paid player at the club, which has been distorted wildly with obviously Alexis Sanchez's contract. Puts him and United in a difficult situation, and that they don't want to pay him anywhere near what Sanchez is on. You know, De Gea's argument is, well, I've been a player of the year for 4 years out of six. Well, you have, but unfortunately, over the last 18 months, it's been a real steady decline. And what started as, you know, he's making a couple of mistakes has become, you know, an issue now. I mean, how long is it? You know, it's been going on for 18 months, the sort of the regular mistakes that you just didn't see, you know, 3 and 4 years ago. So the longer it goes without him signing a contract, you just wonder what is going through his mind. And obviously, for him personally, it's, you know, he may be putting pressure on himself. That's why he's making mistakes, because he's thinking, well, with every mistake that goes on, and that's diminishing his kind of he was in a very sort of high ground in terms of the argument, but that's kind of diminishing now, and he's in quite a difficult situation. United have probably done quite a clever thing, really, in sort of standing firm and not agreeing or not bending to his wishes, because
Oh, we've lost Mark again. Arguably the dodgiest line ever in the history of radio with Mark Flanagan on this day, but just discussing that situation with David De Gea and the fact that he hasn't signed a new contract yet. And of course, that deal with Alexis Sanchez has somewhat skewed what Manchester United players should be earning. I'm just going to move back to that defeat to Crystal Palace yesterday, because there was a huge wave of optimism after that win against Chelsea. Again, the draw in Wolves, you could say, perhaps not the worst result in the current climate of the Premier League, drawing 1-1 at Wolverhampton Wanderers, who are a team that want to infiltrate that top six. But losing to Crystal Palace at home has seems to have really deflated everyone in and around Old Trafford and fans across the world. That attitude of, oh, it's all going wrong, seems to have returned. And it is quite remarkable that Patrick Van Aanholt is the first player in Premier League history to have scored a stoppage time winner at Old Trafford. I mean, in terms of Manchester United's form at the moment, that is one win in their past nine matches. They've scored just 8 goals and conceded 16 in that time. United are only the second team as well to win a penalty in each of their first 3 matches of a Premier League season. So on one hand, you can think, okay, they're lucky. Of course, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer saying that they should have had far more penalties on that. And if you look at Daniel James as well, he is only the 7th United player to score in his first 2 Premier League appearances at Old Trafford for Manchester United. So there are positives to take from this. But of course, the doom and gloom seems to be lifting around Old Trafford. Is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer the right man to take the club forwards? Are there vacancies in the middle of the park there where Paul Pogba, of course, won the ball back to help United back into the game yesterday, but of course lost possession? It seems that the narrative is swinging towards Paul Pogba losing possession and letting Crystal Palace in for that winner, as opposed to winning the ball back and helping United equalise. Next, we are going to be talking to Sam Pilger, long-time Manchester United journalist, after this on Love Sport.
This is Love Sport.
It has been 22, well, it had been, I should say, 22 league games where Crystal Palace hadn't managed a victory against Manchester United. May 1991 was the last time that they managed a league victory over Manchester United. Of course, they finished that in their 23rd attempt yesterday with Patrick van Aanholt's winner at Old Trafford in injury time, the first player to score an injury time winner at Old Trafford. But the catalyst for that 22-game winless streak was Love Sport's very own Paul Mortimer, who scored the opener in what turned out to be a 3-1 defeat for Crystal Palace against Manchester United. We all remember how that season turned out, of course. 91-92, United went head-to-head with Leeds United for that final ever First Division title. They unfortunately didn't manage to go the way that season, but they did win their first title in 26 years the following season, the inaugural Premier League season, of course, under Sir Alex Ferguson, his first title with the club, which followed on from that first FA Cup in 1990, and that was followed by a Cup Winners' Cup in 1991, and that was followed with a League Cup in 1992. The good old days, we like to call them. And at the time, Sam Pilger was watching Manchester United week in, week out, like he is now. I'm delighted to say that we are joined by Sam, sports writer for The Athletic, 442, Forbes, Bleacher Report, The Times Magazine, Esquire, Mail on Sunday, and author of Manchester United's Best 11. Sam, thank you very much for joining us.
That's all right. Good evening. My pleasure.
Great to have you on. Now, Sam, I've noticed that you put a tweet out this evening saying that you're going to be on Love Sport Radio. And I've got to tell you, the reaction kind of sums up the feeling around Manchester United at the moment, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Sometimes it can be an overreaction. It's the third game of the season. But, there's a lot of resentment that was and bitterness that was probably put aside after the Chelsea win, the Wolves draw to some extent. But you lose your third game, your second home game, to a team that is in their seventh or eighth season in the Premier League, but some consider relegation candidates in Crystal Palace. It's going to burst. There's a lot of unhappiness in the light of yesterday.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you alluded to that Chelsea game and 4-0. And listen, whether it papered over the cracks or whatever, it seemed like there was an air of optimism ahead of the new campaign. And a 1-1 draw against Wolves probably isn't the worst result in the world, considering they're trying to infiltrate that top six under Nuno Espirito Santo. But to lose to Crystal Palace, a team, and look, sometimes football works out this way, law of averages and all the rest of it. It had been 22 games unbeaten against Crystal Palace. At some point, they were going to have to win. But I guess it was just the manner of their victory yesterday and the fact that United did claw their way back and Daniel James scored for the second successive game at Old Trafford. To then let it slip was such a disappointment and not something that the United of old, and I know we keep harping on about this United of old and perhaps we need to move on from that, but it is something that Manchester United never used to do in the Premier League.
No, that's right. I mean, and funnily enough, I think if I'm right in saying that was the first time in Premier League history United had conceded a winner in the 90th minute. Mm-hmm. I think it had been a fairly optimistic start to the season, that the win against Chelsea, the draw against Wolves, not being a dreadful result. In fact, when the fixture list was published, it looked a hard start for United. Chelsea at home, Wolves away. So 4 points wasn't too bad, but yeah, it kind of all came crumbling yesterday. But I think, as you said, you know, football is fine margins. You look back to the Chelsea game. Chelsea hit the post twice at 0-0, 1-0. Chelsea really deserved a goal before United scored or before their first goal. The luck was without them yesterday. I think Gary Cahill probably should have been sent off with the tackle on the Martial as the last man. Martial should have had a penalty. I don't quite see how VAR didn't get that on the second check. So United were unlucky. And as you say, yes, I mean, when United equalised with 2 minutes to go, the thought was, is there enough time for a winner? And you know, as you say, the modern-day United, the post-Ferguson United, never mind a winner. In fact, there was time to concede a goal that meant they lost. So, I think it's a reality check. But, yeah, 4 points from the first nine. Unfortunately, I think this might maybe, you know, as we may well talk about, that the inherent weaknesses in the squad, there they were for all to see yesterday.
So where is that? Where are the inherent weaknesses that you've alluded to there? Because I guess a lot of people are trying to pinpoint exactly where Manchester United do fall down. We do seem to have a world-class goalkeeper in David De Gea, but yesterday there was another error and you kind of think that maybe his head is elsewhere, or maybe the batteries have just run out on his time at Manchester United. In attack, you seem well-equipped. You've got Anthony Martial, who's one of the better young strikers in European football. Marcus Rashford is a huge hope of English football. We've signed an £80 million centre-back in Harry Maguire. So the inherent weaknesses, is this a midfield? Is it certain areas of the park? What are you pinpointing on this, Sam?
Well, I think, I mean, the money was provided to significantly improve the defence. Obviously, £130 million on Maguire and Wan-Bissaka. I think, you know, despite yesterday's defeat, both players have made good starts and will be very good additions. Quite clearly, they are improvements on last season. Maguire, Jones, and Smalling, and Rojo, and Wan-Bissaka better on than Antonio Valencia and Young. So there's huge improvement there. But of course, you know, defence is but one of the three areas of the team, and the other areas have been weakened, not strengthened, weakened over the summer. You know, since January, Fellaini, Herrera have left midfield, nobody has joined, and Lukaku, for all his faults, a striker who provided 42 goals in the last two seasons, has been sold with no replacement. And Alexis Sanchez, before the you know, only 18 months ago, one of the best players in the Premier League. United are actively looking to move him on before the European transfer deadline of the 2nd of September. So, the midfield and attack that both need to be strengthened have been significantly weakened. And while the defence has been strengthened, those two areas have been weakened. And I think United will suffer there throughout the season and are very vulnerable to injuries. And even before injuries, look weak there. So I think it's going to be a season of twists and turns, of difficulties. And, you know, the best, unfortunately, and makes United sound like Arsenal for the last 10 years, is fourth place.
Oh, crikey. Sam, you just said United sound like Arsenal. I'm not sure what to do with that. But you also mentioned Alexis Sanchez there as well. Listen, there has been much speculation about him moving on to Roma. There's been speculation about him moving to Inter Milan. Apparently, news coming out of the Italian media, and look, you can't always believe what you hear from the Italian media. You do have to take it with a pinch of salt. But apparently, and this wasn't reported when he was at United and Romelu Lukaku was at Manchester United, but him and Lukaku are quite good pals, and Lukaku is championing his arrival at Inter Milan. You're saying that United are looking quite actively to move him on. Lukaku has gone, and you make a very valid point. This was a guy who scored in Lukaku, you know, one in two pretty much across his time in the Premier League. That's what he's done for Belgium. They haven't been replaced. But with Sanchez, do you think it's going to be likely that he does go? And if he does go, is this a loss to Manchester United, or is this something that Manchester United need to do in order to just get him off the wage bill and move on from what was a disaster of a signing from Ed Woodward?
I think that United are very open to selling him or to moving on the next week. I think they would be delighted to just move him off completely in a permanent deal. I think what's more likely is a loan deal, in which they supplement some of his enormous wage bill. As you mentioned, there were brief talks with Roma. There were more brief talks with Inter Milan. They are certainly open to moving him on. And as dreadful as he has been in the last 18 months with 5 goals and 45 appearances for United, and I've written a feature coming out this week in which, I mean, he actually scored 6 goals in his last 12 games for Arsenal. So he scored more goals in his last 12 games for Arsenal than he has in the next 45 for United. As dreadful as he's been, I don't think you would get much criticism for suggesting that Sanchez was the worst signing in the history of the Premier League in terms of status, and there was no transfer fee, but wage, which is the largest in the history of United. And you think of all the great players that have played for United, Sanchez has drawn a greater weekly wage than any of them. For all of that, obviously United can't buy anyone now until January. I personally would be reckless to sell him because there's no way to strengthen. You only buy the most expensive, only weaken the squad. However, only June, July, and early August, great, makes perfect. You've moved that money off the wage bill. You can replace him. You can't now till January. And so I think, whatever a bad egg or a rotten apple in them, however bad he's been for the squad, so on, the only person who loses by losing Sanchez is United, not Sanchez. And so I would think he's still only 30. You know, he's not 33, 34.
Oh, we do appear to have lost Sam Pilger there, unfortunately. Lines are terrible tonight. It must be something in the bank holiday, son. Of course, he is suggesting that it would be catastrophic, in a sense, to lose Alexis Sanchez, because while his record, and that is a remarkable stat that he gave us, while his record for Arsenal in his last 12 games for Arsenal, 6 goals, is actually better than his record for Manchester United, the fact that Romelu Lukaku is no longer at the club, and in terms of first-choice strikers for Manchester United, in Anthony Martial and Marcus Rashford, not having enough backup. Of course, we've seen Mason Greenwood. He might be a player for this season, but in terms of senior strikers at the club, it is very, very thin. We're going to be talking about that and looking ahead to the Southampton game next week, next on the Manchester United Fan Show on Love Sport.
For the fans, by the fans, Love Sport Radio.
This is the Manchester United Fan Show on Love Sport. I do hope we have no more phone line issues on this hour. We are going to be speaking to Simon Peach, chief football writer for the PA News Agency, in a moment or two. But before that, we just want to touch upon the issue of racism in football and towards Manchester United in general. For the first time since July, Paul Pogba quite notably tweeted today with an image of himself alongside Martin Luther King carrying a baby, and I believe his father or his grandfather as well, saying, "My ancestors and my parents suffered for my generation to be free today, to work, to take the bus, to play football. Racist insults are ignorance and can only make me stronger and motivate me to fight for the next generation." That is, of course, in reaction to, I don't know how you can describe it. I don't even want to afford them the time, but horrible words on Twitter after Paul Pogba missed that penalty against Wolves. We've heard Marcus Rashford has also received similar criticism. Not the first time this season, of course. There have been other instances with Tammy Abraham as well. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has said people on social media hide behind fake identities. Harry Maguire has called it disgusting and said opening a Twitter account should be similar to opening a betting account, for example. Full transparency as to who you are and where you're from. Marcus Rashford quite simply said, "Enough now, Twitter, you need to act." And Phil Neville, the England ladies manager, has said he's lost total faith in whoever runs these social media departments. So let's send a powerful message. Come off social media for 6 months. Let's see the effect it has on these social media companies. Right now on the line, We don't have Simon on the line just yet, but you'd like to think with social media. It's another issue, of course it is, absolutely, with regards to what players put on social media. And on one hand, you think, do you know what? Just leave it. Don't do social media. And that's what Phil Neville is saying. He's lost complete faith in social media and wants players to completely come off social media. But the problem is players are brands now, and they will want to go on social media. They almost need to go on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Snapchat to raise their profiles. It's part and parcel of what footballers are about nowadays. And it is also important to note that with regards to who is giving these players abuse, and we had this on the Chelsea fan show, and the Chelsea fans were very quick to state that it wasn't fans in the stadium that are saying this. It's a few numpties, to quote Gary Neville, it is a few numpties on Twitter that are the ones putting this out to the masses. These are people that you absolutely wouldn't give a minute of the day ordinarily to say things to your face. And it's the sort of reaction that players wouldn't ever experience. But because social media has brought this into the modern world, they are sadly getting this into their inboxes every single day of the week. Like I said, it is the first time that Paul Pogba has tweeted since July. This is a player who is on social media every day of the week. This is a player who lives by social media, who has to use social media to connect with players, to connect with fans, to connect with those around him. Now, we're just going to quickly go back to that Crystal Palace game again, because we've had Sam Pilger and Mark Flanagan on the line today, and the disappointment surrounding the club at the moment and the disillusion, I think. Sam Pilger, for example, was due to come on the show, and he unfortunately had to leave because he had a bad line. But he put out a tweet saying that he was going to be on Love Sport Radio tonight, and the comments and the replies he had were very, very interesting, because instantly people said, right, talk about the Glazers then. Hashtag Glazers out. Someone else said, talk about the lack of spending in our last four transfer windows and how incompetent Ed Woodward is. Someone else said, net spending, this is Martin Kirk, net spending of about 50 million. If anyone else goes before the Euro transfer window closes, Woodward could show a profit. And the only Juan Varon, I do like that Twitter handle very much, has said, what is left to say? I've given up on this season. But when you look at the start of the season and the fact that Manchester United started the campaign with a 4-0 victory over Chelsea, you would have taken that. You would have taken a decent performance from Harry Maguire. You would have taken a decent performance from Aaron Wan-Bissaka, the two debutants. You would have taken Daniel James scoring on his debut, and you would have taken Anthony Martial and Marcus Rashford both scoring in that game. Of course, a draw against Watford isn't the worst result in the world for a team that are trying to infiltrate that top six. Of course, Watford very decent at Molineux. But when you take the results at the back end of last season, Manchester United, and this is the black and white of it, Manchester United have only won one of their past nine matches, scoring just 8 goals in that process and conceding 16. Every so often, landmarks are broken in football. Manchester United, of course, hadn't lost to Crystal Palace in 22 league games, 20 Premier League games, in fact. The last time United did lose to Crystal Palace was May 1991. And Crystal Palace's Patrick van Aanholt scored the winner to end that record and actually become only the second player to score a 90th minute winner against United in the Premier League. Can you remember the last one? Thierry Henry in the 2006-07 season. Of course, Arsenal did the double over Manchester United that season. But Patrick van Aanholt not only is the second player to score a 90th minute winner against United in the Premier League, he is the first player to score a 90th minute winner against Manchester United in the Premier League at Old Trafford.
This is Love Sport.
I'm delighted to say we've got Simon Peach, chief football writer for the PA News Agency and Southampton fan, who does report on Manchester United. Simon, you are qualified, probably the best qualified journalist to speak on the game coming up next weekend.
Yeah, it's the Simon Peach derby in my own little world anyway.
A good result for Southampton this weekend, not so much for Manchester United.
No, Southampton rode their luck a few times against Brighton, but obviously Andone being sent off gave them a helping hand, and so did the VAR decision. I've got to admit, when I saw the alert come through on my phone that Saints had fallen behind, I thought that was that. But they rallied well. They showed a few moments of class and got the win. As for United, it was a difficult day.
What do you make of the problems at the moment? Because I was just talking about it earlier on, and the fact that there seemed to be an air of optimism after that opening day win against Chelsea. The draw against Wolves, you'd say probably not the worst result, but losing at home to Crystal Palace and the manner in which they lost just seems to have brought this cloud over the club again.
Yeah, it was a really untimely defeat. I know they're all bad, but it is easy to forget and get wrapped up in just one loss, as it kind of, if people want to see it that way, it underlines the issues that are there. But 2 weeks ago, they were beating Chelsea 4-0. The first half against Wolves, I was there, and it was the best first half I've seen from a Man United side in a very, very long time. They didn't obviously get the win. They should have. They had that chance with Pogba, the spot kick. And then yesterday, obviously, things just didn't go to plan. But the one thing Ole Gunnar Solskjaer hasn't done is respond from adversity. Yes, I know they started the season well after ending last season well, but they did have to spend £108 million or whatever it was to do that. He hasn't actually managed to get a side firing again after a disappointing defeat, because they do happen. Just look at Tottenham earlier on. So it's a really big challenge for him at St Mary's.
When you say that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer hasn't responded, I mean, there was a great picture. Well, not, it's probably not a great picture, but we looked at, I don't know, an example of Nathan Jones, who's the Stoke City manager at the moment, under huge pressure. You looked at him last week and he was biting his nails on the touchline, visibly under pressure and visibly feeling it. There was an image yesterday where the cameras were on Solskjaer at 1-0 down, and you just saw him almost a bit cowered in his chair. And Mike Phelan was there sort of leaning over, almost as if to say, this is what we should do. I think this is what we should do. But it just seemed like in that moment, they didn't have any answers.
Yeah, it's hard to second guess what was going on, but it is all about how they respond, and they've not. Some of the substitutions I've been a bit underwhelmed with, the decision making, the timing of them, but that will come. But Ole Gunnar Solskjaer knows better than most the pressure to succeed that comes with managing being part of Manchester United. And he does need to, I mean, I hope he doesn't, but he really does need a win at St Mary's to settle people down ahead of the international break.
And that win at St Mary's, we've seen some great wins over the years at St Mary's, some defeats as well. Southampton obviously getting off the mark against Brighton, a good result away from home. There were suggestions that they might struggle this season, but a good victory for them at the Amex.
Yeah, a good victory. And Saints have struggled the last two seasons. That's clear. You need to look at the table and the fact that they had to change managers a few times. But I think Ralph Hasenhüttl has got them playing in an attractive way. Most importantly, he's got people believing again. The transfer business wasn't as impressive as I think a lot of fans would like, especially at centre-back. But Kevin Danzo, who's a versatile defender, made his debut and kept a clean sheet yesterday. So it's just going to be having to trust the manager who certainly says the right things and has a good track record.
In terms of the manager, Ralph Hasenhüttl, he came in and had quite the impact last season. Not a huge amount of activity in the transfer window this summer. Is there optimism for Southampton this season?
Optimistic can be better than two relegation fights, yeah. Optimism that they can get anywhere near the heights they were scaling under Pochettino and Koeman, perhaps not. Look, it does feel like it's going to be a transitional season. They're trying to get rid of a lot of deadwood. They had a rather idiotic transfer policy. It was going well, and then their policy just didn't work, and they've ended up with a lot of highly paid people that might do a job elsewhere in Europe, but nobody else can afford them. So they're now having to get cut price deals to them, try and ship them out, because Hasenhüttl has a clear philosophy and culture that he wants to create within the squad. And a number of these players, like Guido Carrillo, cost £20 million and he's played about 10 games, aren't going to play a part of it. You've got Mario Lemina, who's a very talented player, but he's not going to play a part of it. Lots of these people that they need to move on, and that's why they haven't made the transfer business over the summer. When you've got Fraser Forster, who's the highest paid player in the club's history, the highest paid employee in the club's history, and they're having to ship him out to sell him, I presume, take a whack of his wages. It kind of tells you the situation.
Yeah, a bizarre situation with Fraser Forster. His career has gone in a way that I don't think anybody expected when he was in and around the England setup. You mentioned Mario Lemina there. He was a player linked, actually, with Manchester United, and he did that bizarre thing in the summer of posting his own clips of himself running around. And yeah, I don't know what to make of that when a player puts clips up of himself playing, saying, "You look, come and get me." But it looks like he's not going to play a part at Southampton this season. This is a player who came from Juventus, who you thought was going to light up the Premier League, but it hasn't quite worked. I've spoken to some Southampton fans who said they're absolutely not having him at all.
Yeah, look, this was a guy that, in the month before Southampton played in the Champions League final against Real Madrid and Cardiff, he's an excellent player, he's technically gifted. I just don't think his heart is in it. He may well have been part of Ralph Hasenhüttl's plans if he hadn't spent the bulk of last season. Ralph Hasenhüttl's reign injured last season, and the fact that Southampton, the strongest area they've got in their squad is their midfield. So that plays a part. I did the story, as did a few others, about the interest from Arsenal, Leicester and Man United, and it does. The club still want him out. He still wants to leave. So I would be surprised if that doesn't happen, but I've got to be honest, standing in Santa Monica in Los Angeles, I don't know the exact situation about where the progress is on his exit.
Okay, Sam, before you go, I've got to ask you, Simon, just a quick score prediction on the game.
I'd like a 2-1 Saints win. I suspect it might be a score draw. There was a score draw last season at Mark Hughes. I mean, that was bad enough for Jose Mourinho. If you can't beat a Mark Hughes side, that really shows up. This season, not beating Southampton isn't as big a thing, but they need a positive performance at the very, very minimum, Manchester United.
Lovely. Simon Peach, thank you very much for joining us. That was Simon Peach, chief football writer for the PA News Agency and Southampton fan, who reports on Manchester United. So qualified, certainly, for that chat. Right, that is it. Apologies, huge apologies for the problems we had on the lines this week. It will be much better next week, I'm sure. And we do hope Manchester United's performance will be much better after playing Southampton. Manchester United Fan Show on Love Sport. We'll see you next Sunday at 9 p.m.
This programme was previously broadcast live on Love Sport Radio, so some items may be out of date. For more podcasts or to listen live, visit lovesportradio.com.